It's December. Hey! A miracle occurred in our house yesterday. Our Christmas tree went up. Chris reminded me that there was a time many years ago when our kids were young where Chris said, well, if you don't put up a Christmas tree, Santa won't come. And that was on the 24th of December because they had been asked to put up the Christmas tree. And amazingly, it got done quickly. Yesterday it happened in our house. Christmas is coming, and I think many of you will know our friend Brandon. He comes from the States. He comes out here for 3DM stuff twice a year, and he stays at our house. And like he was out here in November, and he was going back like on the 10th of November, and his job was to get the house set up for Christmas like in mid-November. Who does that? I mean, I know the supermarkets do that, right? But who does that? Does anyone here do mid-November Christmas decorations? But see, the thing with our place is that they usually go up late. But then we're so lazy that there's like February before they get taken down. Christmas is a special time, isn't it? Where we remember the birth of Jesus. God become human. Amazing. In fact, I'm going to read a passage from the beginning of Hebrews which just talks about that in amazing words. Hebrews chapter 1. Verse 1. In the past, God spoke to our ancestors through the prophets at many times and in various ways. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things and through whom he made the universe. The Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word. And after he had provided purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty in heaven, and so became as much superior to the angels as the name he has inherited is a superior to theirs. And so at Christmas, we remember God becoming human. The little baby in the manger is God embodied, is God in human form. Wouldn't it have been amazing to be alive then? With what we know now. I mean, Joseph and Mary and many of those others didn't understand fully who Jesus was then, right? But wouldn't it be amazing for us to be there with what we know now after the benefit of 2,000 years of hindsight and to be there? This is God. The exact representation of his being. And so as we go around over the next few weeks and we see nativity scenes and we see pictures of different artwork of different qualities portraying the Christmas scene, let's always recall to mind that this is God in human form. This is God made physical. This is the exact representation of God. Jesus. Who born, lived, died, rose again, ascended. The exact representation of his being. And in the church calendar down through the centuries, what the church has often done is have used the few weeks in the lead up to Christmas, the time called Advent, to reflect on Jesus' second coming. So there's the first coming of Jesus when he was born over 2,000 years ago, and the second coming of Jesus when he returns in majesty to bring this age to an end and to make everything right again and to make the heavens and the earth new. But today I want to talk about an in-between coming of Jesus. Like, if you like, 1.5. If you've got the first coming of Jesus is Christmas, or the second coming of Jesus in the future where he's coming again, I want to talk about the 1.5 coming of Jesus this morning. And to do that, I want to start in what perhaps seems likely to be a strange place. And that's in the book of Acts. Chapter 9. So this is in some of the earliest days of the church, and Peter and others had been doing amazing miracles and proclaiming Jesus' resurrection to the Jewish people, and then they had some of them had got arrested, and then Stephen, one of the people who had been helping distribute food, got arrested and he got stoned. And Saul, who we later know to be Paul, was there approving of what happened. And then he went around violently trying to persecute the church. Well, he succeeded. He was arresting people, calling them off to prison. And he even got some letters to go from Jerusalem up to Damascus to do the same thing with Jewish people there who had believed in Jesus. And it's a very well-known story for Christians. On the way, there is a blinding flash. He gets a revelation from heaven, and this is what happens. As he neared to Damascus on his journey, this is Acts chapter 9, verse 3, suddenly a light from heaven flashed around him. He fell to the ground and heard a voice say to him, "Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me?" "Who are you, Lord?" Saul asked. "I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting," he replied. "Now get up and go into the city, and you'll be told what you must do." And Saul goes blind, and his companions help him. They take him into Damascus, and then God appears to Ananias, a believer in the city, and tells him to go around to minister to Saul. And he prays for Saul, and Saul gets his sight back, and he gets commissioned as a missionary to the Gentiles. Amazing transformation, the archenemy of the church becoming one of its most effective missionaries ever. But I want to focus on these words in between, where Jesus is speaking to Saul directly from heaven and saying, "Why do you persecute me? Who are you, Lord? I am Jesus whom you are persecuting." Have you ever stopped to think about how on earth Paul, or Saul, was persecuting Jesus? I mean, Jesus was ascended. He was enthroned in heaven. How was Jesus being persecuted? I don't know whether you've ever been persecuted, right? But it usually involves you being physically present. And either someone saying really bad and nasty things about you, or physically incarcerating you, or sacking you, or whipping you, or whatever else it is. Your persecution is physical, right? Whether it's audible, or whether it's verbal, or mechanical, or whatever else, you actually have to be there in person to be persecuted. And yet here is Jesus speaking from heaven saying, "You are persecuting me." And this planted a little seed of thought, I reckon, and Mike Breen's talked about this as well, in Paul's heart. And he ruminated on that, and he pondered on that, and he thought about that. And so years later, he would write these remarkable words in Ephesians chapter 1. He raised Christ from the dead and seated him at the right hand of the heavenly realms, far above all rule and authority, power and dominion, and every name that is invoked, not only in the present age, but also in the one to come. And God placed all things under his feet and appointed him to be the head over everything for the church, which is his body, the fullness of him who fills everything in every way. After years of reflection, Paul's insight was that the followers of Jesus, whom he was persecuting, was the body of Christ. Now, I grew up in an Anglican church, and so we would go through the liturgy every Sunday. And it was a lively Anglican church, but one of the parts of the liturgy would be when we'd be doing, it's called the sharing of the peace, right? And basically it was a time where everyone would go around and hug everybody else, and it would be great. It would be a great sense of community and all that sort of stuff. But the words that we would use from the liturgy at the beginning of that time was, the priest would say, "We are the body of Christ," and the people would say, "His spirit is with us." And then the minister would say, "The peace of the Lord be always with you," and the people would say, "Also with you." So let's going to practice that, shall we? So I'm going to pretend that I'm an Anglican minister. I'm not actually an Anglican minister. I'm going to pretend I'm an Anglican minister. Go with me for this, right? So the words you've got to say are, "His spirit is with us and also with you." All right? So, "We are the body of Christ. The peace of the Lord be always with you." Good, let's do it again. "We are the body of Christ. The peace of the Lord be always with you." Excellent. Now, I said that week after week after week after week for years and years. And oh, Chris is trying to offer a bit of paper to become a dog collar for me. No, I don't think so. I was sat for years and years and years and years. We are the body of Christ. Well, the priest would say, we're the body of Christ, and we say, Spirit is with us. We're the body of Christ, and Spirit is with us. And it sort of gets, and that sort of term, we are the body of Christ, you know, we're the church, it's become like a synonym for the church, right? And it just rolls off the tongue. And for me, it had lost its power. And so today, I want to try and make a small amendment to that phrase to see if I can recapture it for you and for me. We are the embodiment of Christ. We are the very embodiment of Christ. Becoming 1.5. Jesus came physically as a baby 2,000 years ago. He's coming again in the future. But in the meantime, he is coming in us, the very embodiment of Christ. Now, I've got three words to help us respond to that idea, that we are the embodiment of Christ. You and me, our physical arms, legs, what we do, what we say, all those sort of things are the very embodiment of Christ. Three words. And the first word is a really technical word. It is wow. And so I'm going to say, we are the embodiment of Christ, and I want you to say wow. Right? So we are the embodiment of Christ.
Wow.
That is remarkable, isn't it? Jesus so wanted everybody to be able to experience what those first disciples experienced, that he would work it out so that all around the world, wherever there are Christians, people would have a chance to encounter who he was. They couldn't travel in time back to 2,000 years. They couldn't travel back to the land of Israel 2,000 years ago. But if they encountered Christians in the 21st century in Australia or New Zealand or where, Peru or wherever else it is, it would be like them coming up against the very body of Jesus. We are the embodiment of Christ. We are the embodiment of Christ.
Wow.
That's the first word. You've got it. Here's my second word. Another really technical word. Whoa. Because when I think about that, and I think about who I am and what I am like, most of the time I go, woe is me, right? We are the embodiment of Christ. Whoa! That's a heavy thing. Well, that's the thing that I feel like I many times don't live up to, right? And if we have fully grasped this amazing calling that God has given us to be the embodiment of Jesus, to be the hands and feet of Jesus, to be the Christmas from 2,000 years ago in 2017... The first response is, wow, exciting. The second response is, whoa, I don't know whether I can pull this off. And I think of all the ways and times that I have failed and I have not been the hands and feet of Jesus or the voice of Jesus or the attitude of Jesus. But then again, Jesus knew that. That is not a surprise to him. Is it? And Jesus still went ahead with this project anyway. Despite the fact that you and I, in many ways, feel like we fall short of what it is to be the embodiment of Jesus, to be the Christmas of Jesus for our day and our year and our location, He says, I'm going ahead with it, even with, you know, fallible people like David. And so the third word is, another technical word, is how. So we are the embodiment of Christ. Our first response is, wow. Our second response is, whoa. And our third response is, how? Did I sound a bit like Scooby-Doo then? How? There are three answers to how that might happen. The first one is in the traditional response. We are the body of Christ. His Spirit is with us. We are the body of Christ. His Spirit is with us. So the first answer is that it's not us by ourselves, but it's God's presence with us that enables us to be the hands and feet of Jesus right where we are. To speak to people in the same way that Jesus would speak to people, to our neighbour or our work colleague or our friend or our family member who's in difficulty or whatever else, the Spirit of God enables us to do that. So the first thing is that His Spirit is with us. So that first statement is an incredibly bold statement. We are the embodiment of Christ, but that is paired with a great promise. His Spirit is with us. The second thing is in the pronouns. We are the body of Christ. We are the embodiment of Christ. It's not you alone by yourself trying to pull off everything that Jesus did. Rather, it's we, together, a group. And Paul talks about this in other places, like in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, where he says, you know, we're all part of the one body, we need each other. The hand can't say to the foot, I have no need of you. The reality is that I can't pull off being the hands and feet of Jesus by myself, and neither can you. It's a we, it's an us, it's a together. And there's bits of my life that look a bit more like Jesus than they used to. And there's bits of your life that hopefully look a bit more like Jesus than they used to. And when we get all of these imperfect examples of Jesus together, people can hopefully piece together in a collective way what Jesus actually looks like. It's a we. You know, sometimes that you've got those bits of artwork that are made out of, you know, like little bits of ripped up paper, coloured paper or coloured tiles, and you're up close and all you see is the little jagged edges of the tiles and the way they don't quite fit together well or whatever else, right? And there's sort of yellow ones here and red ones there or whatever else. But then you step back a bit from the tiles and you take a bigger view and you see that it actually is a picture made out of these tiles. And there is a sense in which it's a we that's the embodiment of Christ for our day and for our time. And a third thing is that there is room for growth. Jesus, when he was born, was small. He couldn't speak, let alone walk on water. But it says in Luke that he grew in wisdom and stature. And you and I, when we become followers of Jesus, we become part of the embodiment of Christ. And maybe we need to understand that we're only a little bit like Jesus. We're a baby Christian. But God has so organized it that the we works, so that we can all grow up into the fullness of it. In Ephesians chapter 4 it says this, that he gives apostles and prophets and evangelists and pastors and teachers to equip his people for works of service, so that the body of Christ, the embodiment of Christ, might be built up until we all reach unity in the faith, in the knowledge of the Son of God, and become mature, attaining to the whole measure of the fullness of Christ. Then we will no longer be infants tossed back and forth by the waves and blown here and there by every wind of teaching and by the cunning and craftiness of people in their deceitful scheming. Instead, speaking the truth in love, we will grow to become in every respect the mature body of Him who is the head, Christ. So His Spirit is with us. It's not a solo enterprise. And there is room, indeed, an expectation of growth. So that this time next year, collectively together, we should be a bit more mature, a bit more like the full embodiment of Jesus in Chadston. So this Christmas, we are the body of Christ. We are the embodiment of Christ. It's not just the Abigails or other little babies in the Christian church that get to be the little cute baby up the front in the nativity scene. But you and me together, however inadequate we feel, together we are the embodiment of Christ for this place and this time. We are the embodiment of Christ. His Spirit is with us. Wow. Whoa. How? By His Spirit, together, and growing. I hope today that idea that we are the embodiment of Christ is an idea that you just ponder and think about and let it burn in your soul and make this Christmas not just about looking back to the past when Jesus was born. As good as that is, important as that is to do. And not just about looking to the future when Jesus returns. As good as that is and as important as that is to do. But that we would also be looking to how we can be the embodiment of Christ here and now as He has called us to be.